So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review
me. Right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
You people.
What's with him?
You know who I am. But you don't know why I'm here.
Are we going to get security here?
Where is billionaire Ted? Where is the Nacho Man? That punk can't even get in the building. You want a war? You're going to get one.
This is where the big boys play, huh? Look at the adjective, play. We ain't here to play. This show's about as interesting as Marge Schott reading excerpts from Mein Kampf. Where's your three guys? You what, you couldn't get a paleontologist to get a couple of these fossils cleared? You ain't got enough guys off a dialysis machine to get a team? Yeah, where's Hogan? Where's Hogan? Out doing another episode of Blunder in Paradise? Where's the Macho Man, huh? Doing some Slim Jim commercial? Hey, we're here. The measuring stick just changed around here, buddy. You're looking at it.
Welcome to Review Away. I'm John Pollock, and he is Wei Ting, the brains behind this operation.
Why do you say that?
Because you're the one that makes this show happen every week. Because if it was left to me, there would be nothing to produce each week.
Oh my.
We started this show, and the astute Mr. Ting noted that our microphone was not plugged in, and he caught this 3 minutes in.
Mm-hmm.
That was the best banter we've ever had, too, and it's going to be lost to history.
Man, it was so good. It was so good.
Man.
So
you were
good.
Insulting me? You swore at me?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. I had a pun of all puns.
We had a run-in. Like, we had Scott Hall showed up.
He did, yes, and he had to get going, so.
No, let's unplug the microphone. I don't like this one as much. Let's restart this.
No, wait. This is live.
Ah.
Maybe we'll include the banter at the end of the show, which we do have off mic.
Oh wow, we do. Damn,
we do save some things.
Okay,
how are you doing, Wei?
I'm doing amazing. Wow, like I said earlier, I'm in such a really good mood today. I'm just like in a very positive, praising type of mood.
Oh.
I want to praise.
Is there any reason for this mood? Just nicer weather out?
Sometimes you just wake up and you're just grateful.
What, that you're alive? That you woke up?
Yeah.
I never have that feeling. I expect to wake up each morning.
What a big surprise. What a huge surprise. There's going to get to a point, John, where you will be grateful for every breath, every step, every glance.
I think that's overthinking life. You're going to waste all your time just being grateful that you're alive.
So,
there's a certain expectation.
Okay. At what point would you pull the plug?
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. When you can't... Let's say you were paralyzed. Would you...
Neck down, waist down.
Yeah.
Well, those are two different things.
Okay, neck down.
neck down.
Yeah. Would you want to live anymore?
I think it would come down to how much my abilities are hampered. What would I still be able to do?
You could definitely podcast and watch wrestling.
For instance, if I could, if I was confined to a hospital, for instance,
mm-hmm.
and I was just a major drain on my family, I would feel extremely guilty about that.
That's why you get, you pay people. If you had the money, hopefully.
Well, I mean, if I could be out and at least productive, sure, that would be great.
I think your job...
If I was told, listen, you have whatever it is, forget paralysis, a disease, where I am in a hospital and it is not getting better, and these people around me feel compelled to have to come visit me, I would not want that. I would not want that burden.
Right. So, okay.
But so if something were to happen, I'd want it to be
quick. If you're in a hospital, though, you'd just have around the clock care.
What are you waking up for? To go through all of your...
I'm just saying, John, like, of all jobs out there, I feel like your job you can actually still do as a quadriplegic.
In a hospital?
Yeah.
Have you ever tried Wi-Fi in a hospital?
Then get a cable. You ever tried Wi-Fi at the Fight Network? It's probably just as bad.
Do you see this wire here that goes into the back?
Exactly. You don't think you can get that out of the hospital?
No, probably not.
Whatever. Let's say you're a quadriplegic at home, okay? And you have a nurse come in, help you. You could still do basically everything that you do.
I'd probably be fired.
What do you need your arms?
I'd be fired.
What do you need your arms and legs for right now anyway, aside from getting coffee?
Plenty of things. Have you ever watched me on camera? My hands are going a mile a minute.
That's true.
Maybe that would be a
positive. You get somebody to do that for you.
I mean, you on the other hand.
I don't know what I would do.
You'd be in trouble. You could still talk, though.
I could still talk, which is
You've diversified your talents with your thing mouth over the last 9 years.
Oh, God. Doesn't sound good. Definitely doesn't sound good.
Well, when you choose to go down that path... You can make something dirty out of anything.
I don't want to restart this show for sure now.
No.
Well, in some ways, I feel like my shots as a cameraman would be even more stable because I'd be confined to probably a robotic wheelchair. I'd have a portable dolly all the time.
Do you feel within the next few decades that cameramen will be obsolete? Are we just going to have drones?
I feel like, yeah. I mean, I feel like ultimately a lot of these technological... professions might.
This is what you need to
get
do.
Replaced. I think it's already happened over the past like 10 years. I mean, the accessibility and the price of camera equipment has gotten so low that I think a lot of photographers, a lot of videographers, a lot of editors, a lot of people just in the creative arts are finding it probably much more competitive than it used to be, and it's a benefit as well as a hindrance. But ultimately, I feel like you put more of the tools in the hands of people, then you're going to end up with better quality work out there. So I think ultimately, for the sake of art, it's a better thing.
Wow, that's a really good answer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're going to look at some art from World Championship Wrestling, as they took some artistic license with intellectual property in 1996. Via the character of Razor Ramon, returning to WCW. We will probably frequently refer to these two as their WCW debuts.
Yeah.
In fact, this was their second go-around with the company.
Yeah.
Returning as stars when they did not leave as such years earlier.
Yeah.
So we start things off Memorial Day from Macon, Georgia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, wow. That sounds like a town that the WWE doesn't really run that often anymore.
No. But WCW in 1996, they were making it happen.
Good one.
So it was Memorial Day. So people were very excited to take in some Monday Night Wrestling. And this was a notable edition of Monday Nitro because this was their first episode where they had increased to 2 hours.
Two whole hours? Oh, my God.
I wonder if they were concerned about burning out their audience with 2 hours in one night of wrestling.
That's double the length of 1 hour.
Correct. So the goal of this was to get a lead on Raw, because the two were going head-to-head from 9 till 10, and now this second hour of Nitro was going to be airing from 8 till 9, replacing replays of Thunder in Paradise starring Hulk Hogan on TNT, and therefore Nitro would have an unopposed hour to build up the second hour going head-to-head with the competition, and it wouldn't be until February of the following year when the WWF would counter and also move to 2 hours as well. Mm. So in the span of a year, wrestling fans went from 2 hours of head-to-head competition to four.
Yeah.
And yet today, with one promotion out of business for 15 years, we still get three plus.
Yeah, yeah. So more is more.
Yep, you can blame this edition of Nitro for starting this trend of excess when it comes to pro wrestling. This particular episode of Nitro, it did a 2.8, while Raw that same night did a 3.3. They were coming off of their pay-per-view, their infamous In Your House, Beware of Dog, and Beware of Weather Conditions pay-per-view. Mm. And our announce team, which of course were broken up over the 2 hours, Hour 1 featured Tony Schiavone and Larry Zbysko. And then they would flip on over into the second hour. And they previewed the matches for tonight. And I thought one thing I enjoyed about this a lot was that they teed up a lot. And throughout the show, they constantly were referring to what is coming up next, what is still to come, what stars are still scheduled for this show coming up later tonight. There was never that sense of, you go to commercial, what's coming up next? They were constantly ramming it down your throat of all the stars on this show.
And I think a big part of that is probably because they were constantly trying to chase the competition and trying to make sure that audiences stayed and did not switch over to Raw. I feel like that constant threat probably kind of kept them on their toes.
So our first match in the two-hour era featured Ric Flair and Arn Anderson taking on
American Males! American Males! American Males! American Males! American Males! American Males! American Males!
When you say that I'm coming, better run for cover! Girls, you don't need a weekend lover! American Males!
The American Males. Marcus Alexander Bagwell and Scotty Riggs, who came out doing the clap. Two men that are American together.
And male.
American males.
Yeah.
Elizabeth and Woman were in the corner with Flair and Anderson, and they were building up to the big tag match at the Great American Bash against Steve Mongo McMichael and Kevin Green, an active NFL player at the time when players at this level could still participate in professional wrestling, which wasn't going to be happening today.
No, probably not.
Zbysko just runs down football players as a whole, and they mentioned Kevin Green will be on Jay Leno the following night, chatting about this tag match. They double-teamed Riggs on the floor, and then the American Males turned the tables on the floor and got the advantage. Bagwell hit a back body drop, drop-kicked Flair, and then clotheslined him to the floor. And they clear the ring, and they celebrate by doing the clap.
Again, yeah.
Imagine two men so confident in their abilities that they would celebrate in this manner. Doing the old Kid Street clap for you Canadian syndication game show fans.
Right. They just love getting the crowd moving.
Yeah, great clap. Flair has a VIP section ringside with food and champagne. Arn misses a shot to Bagwell and hits his arm into the post. They go through a commercial break. There's champagne here delivered to Schiavone and Zbysko, drinking on the air. They double-teamed Riggs, continue attacking his knee, and then there was a shoving match between Flair and Randy Anderson that the audience got into, led to a hot tag to Bagwell, who came in, hit a missile dropkick to Flair. Series of near falls. Riggs rolled them back after a small package attempt behind the ref's back, and then Arn hit a DDT to Riggs behind the referee's back, with the women distracting Randy Anderson, and Flair rolls on top for the victory. And they celebrate with champagne, with the highlight being Ric Flair taking a glass of champagne and just dumping it over top of his head.
Yeah, yeah. I thought the finish was a little overbooked, but I thought it was a fun match to watch overall. I mean, it's really nice to see, you know, footage of Ric Flair move so well again here. I feel like everything I've seen of him of late is just kind of a period when he's been older. And, you know, the American Males at this point just seem like a very vanilla team of good-looking guys, and the crowd seemed into them. But, like, sort of in, like, an 80s way where, like, oh, we'll cheer for these guys because they're good-looking, you know, vanilla baby faces. But I thought the real standout to me was seeing Arn wrestle here. I mean, I feel like Arn Anderson is a wrestler that I always knew he was a great wrestler, but I think I've developed a greater appreciation for his style as I've gotten older. And it's because he doesn't do anything overly flashy, no flips or fancy submissions or even, like, strikes. But he just does all the fundamentals, all the basic moves with a lot of great aggression, great psychology, and he's just able to make the simplest things look really, really good. So I think I really liked watching him in this match.
Yeah, and as much as they've always been linked through the Horsemen, and of course they'd have the War Games matches together, and this was kind of a period where it was just these two strictly having a bit of a tag run together with just the two of them. Typically, it would be other partners or going in singles directions, and this was a period of time where they were getting a focus. Seeing these two work together as just a strict tag team
These two were clearly positioned as the top heels in the company at the time. And, I mean, I as long as I can remember, I think people growing up with the Horsemen probably remember them strictly as a heel group. But I think for somebody like myself growing up in the 90s in sort of like that post-NWO era, that heel threat was always taken over by the NWO, and this was kind of the beginning of that. And at that point, you know, Flair and the Horsemen just kind of became your babyface opposition for the NWO.
Yeah, you had the combination of, I mean, the Horsemen probably could have been very good babyface foils. You had the issue with Arn Anderson would have to end up retiring after an injury later on this year. Then Ric Flair would suffer a really bad shoulder injury that required surgery. And coming back, I mean, you saw the struggles that Ric Flair had throughout 97 and then 98, where he was off television for a significant amount of time. And there were a lot of heels at this time who kind of were, the NWO came in like a tidal wave. Mm-hmm. And a perfect example of the Giant. Watch how so much is built around him at this point as the big heel champion. And he was kind of swept into that as well, where he just became another guy in the NWO before they would finally flip him over as a babyface later.
Right.
And he had numerous turns, which I guess would be a career path for the man. Gene Okerlund interviews them in the VIP section. Arn says he has never met a football player that he couldn't walk over to find a better fight. Great line. And Flair has never met a woman he could not get. Both men with their strengths. And says there's no protective gear in wrestling. Flair says that the NFL commissioner better step in and stop this tag match from happening. And then, like a shark going after chum, just attack these women's arms with kisses. He was like gnawing at the arms of woman and Elizabeth.
It was disgusting. It was all sweaty.
But champagne doused all over the top of him. Mm-hmm. It's a wild man.
And you had Liz and a woman here just having an act.
Looking so uncomfortable at this man attacking them with his lips.
But what about what Liz says when she's questioned here?
Well, Flair, after trying to eat the arms off of these two women, states how Deborah belongs to the Nature Boy, Deborah McMichael, the wife of Mongo. And Elizabeth is asked about this, and Elizabeth says...
Elizabeth, well, she's asked, hey, are you... does it bother you that the Nature Boy is going after another woman?
Deborah belongs to the Nature Boy!
Well, I don't know about that. Elizabeth, what are your feelings about... is this too timing in your estimation?
Oh, no. The champ can have anything he wants. Oh.
She says she has no problem and the champ can have whatever he wants, so... I mean, I feel like we've definitely come a long way. But not that far. Not that far.
This would be women as Rick would probably describe as wife material. There was training footage with Steve McMichael and Kevin Green. just awesome. Awesome video montage here. Yes. These guys working out in the gym. Just imagine the two guys you would just absolutely hate to be sharing a gym with. This, just two muscled up dudes yelling at one another to push them and using the lines, rip and rock, baby, rip and rock.
Oh, these came across like Tim and Eric sketches. Like, and now just, oh my God, incredibly cheesy. And like the music was just exactly what you would expect from a 90s workout montage featuring Steve McMichael and Kevin Green. I mean, Jesus.
Two like, jocks working out.
Mongo was doing these dumbbell rows screaming, flare, 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 flare for each rep. It's some great 90s video stuttering effects, cheesy, generic rock track. Just a couple meatheads working out.
Well, that was their primary description in 1996.
The UFC Embedded should start being like this.
Yeah, I mean, their training footage pales in comparison to what we saw here with Mongo and Kevin Green. If anything, this gave us a break from Steve McMichael commentator, which actually ended his commentary run, which was a positive for Mankind. Then we had the match that I will call the trivia answer.
Yeah.
Steve Dahl taking on the Mauler.
The most important match on the show.
Yes. These are the trivia question of what was the match that started off the infamous NWO angle involved Steve Dahl, formerly of Well Done.
A man with hair like Farrah Fawcett's.
Yes. Taking on Mike Enos, formerly of the Beverly Brothers. Now just known as the Mauler. Because if ever there was someone that I see a Mauler in, it's this guy who used to have a cape and loud purple and white tights.
Hmm.
The Mauler.
Well, now he's wearing leather chaps.
With Colonel Robert Parker as his manager. This match, lots of yelling to the crowd prior to this follow-away slam. Mauler's gimmick was to yell and tackled him over the top to the floor. Dahl got ran into the post, and Zbyszko says that he tells these guys to get haircuts because of reasons like this where you get thrown by your hair. And then Shivani refers to Steve Dahl as the youngster, the 35-year-old youngster. And they come back from commercial break. This actually got two segments. And then we see Scott Hall arriving with a nice tribute to us, Mr. Ting. It might have been Memorial Day, but he was clearly celebrating Victoria Day from the week prior in his Canadian tuxedo here.
Huh.
Jean jacket, jeans, and comes in. And Hall just takes the microphone, and Steve Dahl and the Mauler know to just get the hell out of here. We're done.
Done my job.
And he goes in full Razor Ramon delivery with the accent, the toothpicks. You people, you know who I am, but you don't know why I'm here. And he talks about billionaire Ted, the Nacho Man. Shivani played this up as he was very concerned about what was happening to this program. He asks where Scheme Gene is. He mocks WCW and says, if you want a war, you're going to get one. And the only man in the entire universe that followed this with this particular question, Tony Schiavone, says, after this, what about the match? What happened to Steve Dahl and the Mauler? And that is what followed this historic moment. What about the match?
That's the question that we're still asking 20 years after.
So this is the appearance everyone remembers. I think the appearance later in the show is kind of forgotten that there were two Scott Hall segments on this show. But it was after this way, immediately, that the World Wrestling Federation sent a cease and desist to Scott Hall and WCW that this was so blatantly Scott Hall taking his Razor Ramon persona and coming on to Nitro and insinuating that he is with the WWF and kicking off an invasion angle that the WWF is somehow a part of. And I thought the WWF completely justified in what that's exactly what WCW was trying to get across here.
Of course, but in the end, you have to give the win to WCW for attempting it, because it totally worked. And just even angering the WWE, was a plus, in my opinion, to help sell this angle. And I think we all remember it, obviously. And today, I feel like if they did this exact same thing in the same style of delivery, obviously the fans would start to see right through it. You know, why would this guy get a live mic and the cameras are focusing on him? But back then, I feel like this was very novel, probably, and we were all probably a lot more gullible. I was, for sure. And I thought it still held up. You know, I think it's still a great moment to look back on, and probably the biggest match of Steve Dahl and the Maulers' lives.
Well, certainly, I think after this as well. I mean, WCW, despite the legal warnings, I mean, the following week, and even the June 10th episode we're going to get to, I mean, he did not ditch that accent at first. And it did. They ultimately did come to a standoff where they had to awkwardly have Bischoff ask them, do you guys work for the WWF? And they said no. They did have to make that clear because they were putting themselves into a legal situation by creating this.
As they should have. You know, look at the benefit that it did for the company. And in the end, they didn't lose anything. They gained all this publicity. They managed to gain the interest by having people believe that initially this might have been what it was. And I thought it was brilliant either way. The story is that this was based off of something from Japan. What exactly was that?
That would have been the UWFI that Eric Bischoff saw firsthand was coming and doing the program with New Japan, where you were able to do a similar invasion style storyline. And this was at a time when WCW, they had this budget that they could bring in Scott Hall and Kevin Nash for a lot of money, and this was probably the best way to do it, rather than simply bring out Scott Dahl, for instance. And
Scott Hall and Scott Dahl? Wow. No, we're talking Steve Dahl. I do wonder if they talked about the idea of having Hall appear, you know, in more of a traditional Scott Hall attire instead of the jean. I'd like to know what the thinking was behind the jean vest and jean pants.
Yeah, I guess they could have gone full out and had him with a super loud shirt.
And the chains. I guess you can't do the chains.
Well,
that would have been too blatant.
Yeah. And to be honest, I think what you wanted here, if you were WCW, thinking in the moment and not, you know, trying to kind of dance that line here between what they could get away with or not, was you did want to present this guy as... You didn't want him fully as Razor Ramon, but you did want to present the strengths of that character, but put him into a real-life situation here as representing WWF.
But aren't we talking about the WWF who hired Ric Flair along with the big gold belt and positioned him as the world champion in their own company?
Well, that was a more complex one because at that time, Ric Flair had to put down a deposit when he got that championship, a deposit that he never got back, and therefore he believed he had ownership of that title. Yeah. And when he brought it to the company, it also resulted in a legal issue where they had to blur out the title and eventually phase that title out. And then there was, of course, the Medusa one as well, where she brought the women's title onto Nitro. And during all of this, I mean, there was a precedent set that championship belts are intellectual property of each promotion, and therefore, that's why that kind of blows the whole Montreal paranoia out the water in terms of had they brought that WWF title that Vince McMahon was so paranoid they were going to do with Bret, it would have been a massive, massive lawsuit because the precedent had been set that that is intellectual property of the WWF. And WCW was not going to do that because of the legal situations they had already gone through.
I think they would have just paid the legal bills and said, "Hey, look, we have this on footage forever."
I don't think they would have. I really don't.
What about when Rhino threw out the ECW belt on TNA?
Well, that would have been. That was one where they didn't push further to do anything with, but you could have certainly made a case there as well that the WWF bought all the remnants of ECW in bankruptcy court, and that would include all their championships.
I feel like at this point, like Bischoff seemed like his perspective was, well, we're going to do it, and we're going to do whatever we can, and then we'll deal with it after the fact. And it made for some very entertaining TV.
Absolutely. I think that was the part that the hook of this was, is this really happening? Because mm-hmm. this was the head-to-head battle at this point. This was the fantasy booking of every single fan, was what would happen if you had both sides converge to work together. And that was what they wanted to convey here, or at least dangle that question out and leave it open-ended for as long as they possibly could. And then, to their credit, they eliminated the WWF aspect of things and replaced it with their own brand in the NWO, which was essentially the WWF, was played by the NWO.
Yeah.
That was it. That was the whole crux of the angle.
I thought Hall was a really great choice as well to lead this whole thing off with. I mean, the guy played a very iconic character from that period in the WWE that you would be able to identify even without, you know, the guy wearing the same attire. Just to hear that Razor Ramon voice on a WCW show was a really cool thing to see, and I thought he did really well here.
From there, we come back from break, and there was a subtle reference about surprises on this show that have been expected and unexpected, which was our only reference to Scott Hall showing up. And then we followed that with Sergeant Craig Pittman with Teddy Long. Of Teddy Long.
Oh, man.
He was a few weight classes higher in 1996. This
is Teddy Wide.
Taking on Diamond Dallas Page. And Page had recently won the Battle Bowl at Slamboree. And Page was mocking Pittman with push-ups, took the back of Page, and then gets broken up in the ropes, headbutts Page, and gets sent to the floor. Pittman goes for the Code Red, an armbar, but Page is upside down here, they note, and Long distracts them, and it leads to Page getting up and hitting the Diamond Cutter and winning this match in 3 minutes.
Were there many guys with armbar finishers, or like even, you know, MMA finishers that we would still see, you know, in an MMA setting back then in North America?
In North America, especially in WCW or WWF, not really at this point.
We could be calling the armbar the Code Red. If this guy got more popular, we'd be watching the UFC and Ronda Rousey with the Code Red. That's what we'd all be saying.
That could have been it. The Code Red could have really taken off. At this point, I mean, Sergeant Craig Pittman was... I remember I had this Sergeant Craig Pittman action figure.
Yeah.
This, like, they had those, like... They were, like, knockoff LGN figures. That, like, yeah. And they were just...
Poor guy.
Yeah, but he was just...
Why did you get the Craig Pittman? I'm sure we've had this discussion before.
It was actually my brother who purchased the Sergeant Craig Pittman figure, as I recall. But he was just, like... super wide with, like, his arms out, and he had his like, military hat on.
Why did your brother buy that one?
Just a collector, I guess, yeah.
I had, for the longest time, I didn't have many wrestling toys growing up, but the ones I did have were the Hasbro ones, where they just, like, could do one move. They were all permanently positioned in a clothesline position. And I went on a trip to Singapore once, and I went to a convenience store, and my mom bought me a toy, and it was the only wrestling toy there, and it was a Rick Steiner in full tie-dye with the neon green headgear, and that was my wrestling toy memory, Rick Steiner.
Wow. Rick Steiner, of course, sharing a birthday with yours truly.
Oh, nice.
Randy Savage video was next. He's lost his mind, and he's been banned from Nitro. He attacked some referees, hit an elbow drop onto one of them, and they advised Randy to go see a psychiatrist. And he was arrested on a recent edition of Nitro. His bank account has been drained by Elizabeth as they show her throwing money off to the fans and paying for Ric Flair's food, and they state that the Macho Man is lost. And this was a big program in 1996. It was Ric Flair and Randy Savage that was the house show program that really did spike WCW's attendance. This was a very profitable feud for WCW, and it, I mean, certainly the NWO gets a lot of credit for WCW catching fire mid-96, but it was this feud that they took everywhere that really started to set the tone for WCW's business going up in 96. Hmm. And, yes, Randy Savage having... look at all the heavy subjects that we were tackling here. I mean, divorce, alimony payments that were being spent by Elizabeth, psychiatric evaluations for Randy Savage. I mean, this was quite this was like a mental health angle in 1996.
Yeah, sure. Was this played off of, did they basically continue this off of like WrestleMania 8?
I mean, they subtly, you know, discuss their history, but I mean, these two had been...
Or was it a new storyline?
It was like the WCW version of the feud, because Savage had been there since 94 already.
Right.
They had been feuding throughout 95 and into 96 at this point.
Because, I'm just trying to figure out if WCW was more likely to acknowledge the existing storylines from the WWF versus, I feel like if the WWF were to acquire these guys, they would just completely ignore what came before.
I mean, it wasn't... there were references when it was convenient. I mean, they certainly linked Hall and Nash as buddies together. And remember, this was like a week after the curtain call. So everyone knew that these guys were... You had that believability that these guys are friends working together. Even later on in this show, one of the shows at least, it was bringing up Lex Luger, who's beaten Yokozuna with that same flying forearm. So it wasn't as if they just, especially, I mean, WCW never tried to operate in their own universe. They would make tons of references to WWF, whether it was Knox or even acknowledging histories.
It definitely always seemed like Bischoff was watching the WWE product a lot more than Vince was watching WCW.
Yeah, it was very rare that you would see. I mean, look at Mankind and Vader when they had they were kind of programmed together in the WWF, and you had a golden opportunity to tell that story with the ear, and they really never went that direction. In many cases, when those things presented themselves, Gene Okerlund, this is my highlight of both weeks, by the way, was with Shark. Backstage. Actually, this was not my highlight. It was the following episode with Shark.
The Shark, John Tenta.
John Tenta, but he's not John Tenta yet. He is still Shark. And he yells at Jimmy Hart for losing at Slamboree and yelled, "I'm blank," at Jimmy Hart's face.
I'm blank.
It was just, there was no, it was like either...
He said, "I'm blank"? He said blank?
It was either muted or he just... didn't speak. It was just, "I'm blank," at Jimmy Hart's face. And I was trying to figure out what he was trying to imply here.
What would they have censored on the network here?
I don't know.
I'm
not even quite sure if it was censored. There was just... it might have just been incomprehensible.
I'm pissed.
"I'm not supposed to be upset. I'm in Jimmy Hart's face."
He says that he's been thrown out of the Dungeon of Doom, and he is going to hurt Kevin Sullivan tonight and going to win the WCW title tonight. Can you imagine this? World champion Shark.
Yeah.
I mean, a perfect champion going into Bash at the Beach.
Oh.
With that logo.
Oh, my.
And instead of the shark, it's John Tenta.
You have to wrestle a live shark. That should have been the match.
Oh, my God.
Bash at the Beach.
That could have been, Hogan having to chase after Shark to win the title.
Actually, remember Brock Lesnar F5'd the shark in that SummerSlam commercial?
Oh, boy. Yeah. He threatens to eat Jimmy Hart after for dessert. This was pretty great. It was as though he had taken over the characteristics of a shark. Like, he would eat this man, and that he was half man, half fish.
He should have just, wobbled away like he was swimming.
Put his, hands together and just make a shark movement.
Yeah. Yes. Exactly.
I mean, he should have come out to, a Jaws theme.
Very interesting choice of a gimmick. I mean, I suppose, there have been successful animal-based wrestling characters in the past. I mean, a Junkyard Dog, sure, but I feel like a water animal is tougher to sell in a wrestling environment. How many water animals have been successful? Like Aquaman is constantly made fun of. Why would you base yourself off of any type of fish? You know?
What about the Little Mermaid? Overcame a lot of adversity.
Yeah, she had to shed the mermaidness though to really be successful.
That's true. That was almost an anti-mermaid movie when you think about it.
Yeah. But can you think of like any? There's no fish. Like, have there ever been any fish gimmicks? That would be your gimmick.
A fish?
Yeah,
I guess.
The pollock.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then we had Hulk Hogan, essentially a vanity video package of him hanging out with Hollywood celebrities during his time off at this moment in WCW.
This was the best part of the show.
Is it? The line was used here during this video. He is more than just the greatest champion in history. That's not enough of an accolade for this man. They show him boxing with George Foreman from 2 years ago, hanging out with Shaq, Dennis Rodman at Bash at the Beach last year, Kevin Green. They show him at charity events, raising money, Sugar Ray Robinson, who gave a non-coherent message at the end that desperately required a second take but was not asked. And this felt like a man recovering from a scandal and needing positive PR.
Yeah.
This could air next week if they were bringing him back to Raw.
This video, I felt, was done to show you and I, John.
Like, I'm not kidding. Like, I don't want to make this like the Hulk Hogan racist story, but I mean, he was positioned here with all these black athletes.
Yep. He loves black people, clearly.
He loves charities.
Yeah.
He's just a great guy. He's George. The greatest champion ever, but that's just scratching the surface of this man's great attributes.
Yeah. I mean, seriously, though, George Foreman, Shaq, Dennis Rodman, Sugar Ray Leonard, it's quite interesting watching this in 2016.
Hour two kicked off at 8:50, Mr. Ting.
Yep, they had to get the jump even more.
Which, this is like, maybe wrestling just has a whole different approach to time and calendars. I mean, maybe Raw did turn 1,200 years old on Monday, and this is the start of the second hour, 10 minutes earlier.
Sure. I'll meet you at 8:50 then. We should end the show at 2:50.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway.
So, to get the jump on Raw, they kicked this off at 8:50 with our new announcers, Eric Bischoff, who welcomed us to the second hour by saying, "We are locked, cocked, and ready to roll," with Bobby Heenan, who said nothing of the sort.
Yeah. Did you notice here? So they do that big opening, right, with the pyro and all that. So, and they have the camera guy here run up into the ramp, and this dude almost got set on fire. He almost got engulfed in flames. He walked all the way up to the stage to shoot something, and then these flames came up like right in front of him. So
they would have blamed Scott Hall.
Why?
He had taken over the pyro.
Oh, okay. Yes.
You want a war? Mm-hmm. The first casualty of war is a camera operator.
Wow.
Bischoff says he will not even dignify the interruption from last hour, as he would go on to mention it about five more times before the end of the show, and each time saying he's not going to dignify it with a response by bringing it up on his own volition.
Yeah.
What a promoter. So to kick off hour number two, we had the Giant versus Shark for the WCW Championship. The Shark, billed from Tsunami.
My God.
That's some pretty clever geography. That's like way you being billed from Tornado. Like these are... He's, I guess, a natural disaster, but couldn't be billed as being from Earthquake, for instance. Oh, so he's from Tsunami.
Yeah.
A shark that was brought about from a tragedy.
Yeah.
There was a double axe off the second turnbuckle by Shark. He tried for a slam and was stopped, and Giant lifted and scoop-slammed Shark. Bischoff says he would have eaten this desk if Giant could slam Shark. Shark then... What a silly name I'm referring to here. gouges him in the eyes, drove his shoulder into his thigh repeatedly, and then there's a clothesline off the second turnbuckle that takes the Giant off his feet. Jimmy Hart gets onto the apron. Giant then grabs him, hits a chokeslam for a big reaction, and pins the Shark in 4 minutes. Keep in mind, this is Paul White. This is May. He had had his first match the prior October, and wow. I would say this was the best use of Paul White during his whole WCW tenure, and this was as
you can argue, including
significant portion of WWF.
Yeah, I thought they handled him very well.
Short matches, great. Like he was a pretty athletic guy that could move around,
and he could actually seem very comfortable on the mic too.
Great visual that this guy walking out, he looked gigantic.
Yeah,
and they knew what his strengths and weaknesses were, and he had a great aura about him. I felt during this 1996 period, it wasn't. I mean, he was kind of a Matanza at this time. He came in and just ran through guys.
Yeah. And obviously, a match like this, you don't expect, you know, any type of fast-paced, high-flying action. But I thought it showcased some impressive feats of strength from the Giant. And it wasn't too long or even boring, so I thought it was totally fine.
But then the big angle was to come afterwards as Shark is left on the beach. And out comes Big Bubba, who comes and shaves not his entire skullet, but half of it, leaving him half bald. And Bischoff calls this the most disgraceful thing a wrestler can do to another wrestler.
Shave half his skullet.
This is the most disgusting thing anyone can do to another wrestler. So that was it.
Yeah.
Big feud to come with Big Bubba and Shark. The Dungeon of Doom was imploding.
Weird. It's like Big Bubba and Shark. Like I wonder how many people even listening to this podcast can visualize who those people are. But it's the Big Boss Man and it's Earthquake. But it's just so weird that we have this alternate dimension where these two are known as Big Bubba and the Shark.
Yes. And we got the Shark Attack by Bubba.
But I just mean both these guys were like, you know, whatever, Boss Man and Earthquake. They're just both guys who just tried to make that transition to WCW while trying to play the same character but with a slightly different name. And just nothing ever took off.
Well, this was a better attempt than Ray Traylor as the Guardian Angel or just the Boss. Mm. So we were at least at Big Bubba by this point. Bischoff comes back and brings up Hall again. And says he can come out later and issue his challenge. So telling you, you will see Scott Hall again. But first and foremost was another title match. This one for the television title is Lex Luger defended against Max.
Max.
With two X's.
Max Muscle.
Yes. I think they just abbreviated it now to Max.
Yeah, Max, because he was...
Had he lost his muscle?
He was... Yeah.
Didn't appear to.
Gained an extra X.
He looked...
Power plant guy.
Very much a power plant guy, yes. Max also sporting a mohawk. Luger was getting set to headline the Great American Bash, where he would go after the WCW title against the Giant, so he was being built up for that. Max is favoring his left leg after a slam, and then Bischoff yells off camera that he can wait until the end of the hour. Which was a nice little touch, something we were not supposed to hear, but did. So you knew when Scott Hall was coming.
Yeah, I thought it was really nice, too, saying it off camera and shouting it.
I thought Eric Bischoff, for all the times when you see attempts at this and it's just really...
Especially after this.
You have to try and suspend disbelief during invasion angles, and it becomes tougher and tougher. I thought Eric Bischoff paid a lot of attention to little details, and such as this, that really did make this feel... If you were a viewer in 1996, you would have your questions.
Absolutely. I mean, and he also had to kind of play a balancing act where he had to play it off like he didn't want to mention it. But at the same time, he really did have to remind the audience to come back in at the end.
You can't get too silly into the weeds. I mean, at the end of the day, you want people tuning in to see this giant star that you have acquired at the key point in the main event angle of the show with your head-to-head competition. So that has to be first and foremost. Max got the heat as the crowd was chanting for Luger. They teed up as well. Kevin Sullivan and Chris Benoit, the Great American Bash. And Bischoff says that Benoit looks at the Taskmaster as a bit of a homewrecker. Luger gets his boot up in the corner.
Oh, my God. That's weird.
That's what he said. Hits the forearm, and this is where Bischoff says that the forearm that Luger has beat Yokozuna, who, of course, was key guy in the WWF at this point. And then Luger applies the torture rack and defeats Max at 538.
Yeah, it's not a pretty match.
Yes.
Not a pretty match at all.
They went above his max limit, I feel, in this match. Okerlund interviews Luger in the ring. He is very defensive about those criticizing how he got this title shot over DDP, saying the championship committee makes the matches, not him. This was like almost every other MMA interview you hear, where a guy has been gifted a title fight, and he's not going to apologize for it.
Mm.
Blame the championship committee. And they show Luger being chokeslammed through a table on Nitro, and Okerlund called it awesome when this happened. And Luger says, "I can't believe you did that." And Okerlund just replies, "What do you mean you can't believe that? We just saw it on video." And Luger wants to fight all of the big men in WCW before he faces the Giant, promising some classics before the pay-per-view.
Yeah, I don't know about the promise of those matches, but I like the storyline of Luger chasing other big men in preparation for the Giant. I think it makes a lot of sense, and it's super simple.
Well, two men he would not be facing were Hard Work Bobby Walker and Brad Armstrong, as WCW was...
More power plant guys. All these power plant guys that we've never heard anything else about.
Well, shit. Brad Armstrong was pre-
not power play, not Brad Armstrong, but
hard work Bobby Walker. Yes, his gimmick was he worked hard. He was the first guy at the gym and the last one to leave, and they stated he studies film as though he is preparing for a thesis and works until 2 or 3 a.m. at the power plant every night, which maybe explained why he was really off in this match, because he was just tired.
Yeah, you should.
With his travel on top of this, though this was in Macon, so this was a short trip from the power plant. Bobby Walker was just, I think, way too ambitious with some of his attempts in here.
Yeah.
There was a monkey flip, and Walker tried to land on his feet and just lost his footing, then scaled to the top and loses his balance, but did recover to hit a reverse cross. They promoted Rey Mysterio, making his WCW debut at the Great American Bash, and he would face Dean Malenko.
He doesn't work as hard.
No, where's he? Right. Walker then leaps up to the top. Again, he loses his balance and hits his version of the blockbuster and pins Armstrong at 427, which Bischoff calls an upset. Hardly a flawless match.
Yeah, hard work here. Just
not enough work.
No, I thought it maybe a little too ambitious with a lot of his moves and maybe too nervous, too. He worked fast and maybe seemed a little too rushed, but he clearly had potential.
They had this great WCW magazine ad, which was this little kid in Sting face paint, and then Sting would be transformed into the kid, but it was still the kid's voice on Sting's mouth.
Yeah.
Then vice versa.
It was the morph effect, like the Michael Jackson black or white video.
Yep. This magazine way that you could pick up now had a full rundown of WCW Uncensored, which took place 2 months ago.
Wow! This WCW magazine is really cool!
In the June issue, get inside the demented mind of the Giant.
This is Mulder!
Find out what the Mistress of Dirty Tricks is up to now. Plus, exclusive photos of the chaos at Uncensored.
Where do they get this stuff?
Get your copy now on newsstands everywhere.
I'm really glad they keep these in the WWE Network versions. Whoever was in charge of...
It'd be very easy to cut these out. I'm glad they don't either.
No, they keep all these cheesy ads.
I mean, they keep the hotline plugs in there and they've had to do work to say that the number's not in service.
You know, wrestling fans get a kick out of watching these.
I would have left the number there. Let the idiots call.
Yeah.
Lord Steven Regal with his butler Jeeves against Das Wunderkind Alex Wright.
This was a fun little surprise I didn't expect to see on this show.
Yes, 21-year-old Alex Wright. It just turned 21 here. Bischoff assures everyone that Hogan is watching Nitro and WCW very closely while he is away. I bet. there was a tope to the floor as they go to break. And Bobby Heenan calls Wright an idiot for trying to pin him on the floor. And during the break, speaking of ads that they kept in, we got a Blood Runs Cold spot, which this was, of course, the running gag at the time was the amount of promos for this. This was May. Glacier would finally appear in September, and another big idea they had that was steamrolled by the NWO and became...
To be fair, even without the NWO, I don't know how successful this thing was.
They had big, big plans for this. They thought this was going to be a great playoff of Mortal Kombat, and Glacier was going to be this character that they could market.
But, man, I mean...
They were going to have a whole stable of guys.
There's no way 5-6 months of promos would have left the audience feeling satisfied once they saw this guy actually debut. No, I mean, I don't know what they could have done to have him live up to these constant vignettes, but it certainly wasn't what we actually ultimately saw.
These spots ran all summer. He wouldn't appear on television until September. Bischoff gives a shout-out to a fan, Dave Renica, watching at home. Regal goes to the Regal stretch. There's European uppercuts from Alex Wright. And Bischoff is upset over Scott Hall and his promo where he insulted the fans. He says, it doesn't matter about billionaire Ted and Scheme Gene jokes, but he draws the line at insulting our fans. Wright leaps to the top and backflips off the top into a roll-up. And then Regal, as he's got like a crossface on Wright, looks into the camera and cuts this promo on other guys coming from other wrestling companies trying to take something from him when they don't deserve it, saying, I don't think so. He got this whole thing in.
Yeah.
Into just the camera at ringside.
Mm-hmm.
Good use of his time.
Mm-hmm.
Wright then lands a high drop kick. Regal blocks a monkey flip and uses a jackknife cover to pin Alex Wright at 7:14. Sony PlayStation brought us the replay. And then Okerlund interviewed Regal in the ring and wants his opinion on Americans on this Memorial Day. And Regal calls Okerlund a miserable little toad.
Now I have your attention. It's Memorial Day. My father will be so pleased I beat Junior Adolf there.
And says that his father would be so proud that he just beat Junior Adolf.
I couldn't believe he said that.
Holy Christ.
I couldn't believe he said that.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Oh, he calls the Giant an escapee from Barnum and Bailey's. Lex Luger is pretending to be a hard man and says he's going nowhere and he will have his bloody say about what goes on here in reference to Scott Hall's appearance, then challenges Sting in order to get a shot at the circus freak, the Giant.
What could they have possibly edited from John Tenta's promo if they kept this in?
Well, again, I don't know quite if that was actually an edit in the Shark promo or if it was just Shark was having difficulty with his words.
Junior Adolf.
Junior awesome. Adolf. Remember, folks, this same service digitized Lance Storm's middle finger at Living Dangerously 99. So Junior Adolf reference at the German baby face was okay awesome. As an insult. Yeah. Say what you will, though, about the content. Regal's, I thought his promo...
So awesome.
Yeah, like, this great. Guy was... You watch this episode and the following show that we're going to review here. He was going into a pay-per-view with Sting. This felt like a guy they were really getting behind.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe not a big pay-per-view opponent, but this, to me, would have been a great opponent for, say, a Scott Hall or a Kevin Nash for television to just have, you know, a guy representing WCW that's not too high up the totem pole, but you could have a competitive match with and put some heat on your new guys. I felt Steven Regal was someone that they were putting a lot of focus on, and these were some good promos.
Clearly very talented, and I really liked this match. It was really nice to be able to see Regal work this full-on European style with somebody who's also obviously very well-versed in it, and especially a younger Regal, very intricate, very technical wrestling. And Alex Wright,
guy that never truly reached his potential, in my opinion. Yeah. I was a big fan of Alex Wright's, and this guy was, again, 21 years old at this time in 96.
In ring here, he looked tremendous as well, so I always like finding these hidden gems in these reviews.
And our main event of this Nitro was Sting versus Scott Steiner, both babyfaces. They showed this little kid with a mullet who looked miserable holding up a Sting action figure at ringside. They shook hands to start the match. Sting leaped off the second turnbuckle and hit Steiner with his back. This was not a reverse elbow. This was him kind of the spot that Stardust would do, where he just leapt backwards and connected with his back to Steiner. And then followed with a pescado to the floor, and Bobby Heenan provided a PSA here, calling it too dangerous. His knee could have hit the guardrail. You've wow. got to be safer. Bobby Heenan would have... He would not last calling...
The Asylum match.
Boy, half of the match. Can you imagine calling an AJ Styles match at Extreme Rules?
Yeah.
Bischoff tells Heenan that we will be seeing Rick Steiner later on tonight, pretty much promising you a run-in. And Steiner hit a double underhook, followed by a belly-to-belly suplex. Sting's on the floor. There was an STF applied by Steiner. Very dead crowd at this point. Sting then counters a vertical suplex and hits an inverted DDT before it was part of his arsenal, or at least a finish for him. Steiner hit a dragon suplex to Sting. And then Luger comes down to cheer on Sting, followed by Rick Steiner, as promised by Bischoff. Sting holds on to the ropes during a Frankensteiner attempt, applies the Scorpion Deathlock, but Steiner's at the rope. And then Steiner goes for a tombstone. It's reversed, and Sting hits a tombstone, identified as a pile driver by Eric Bischoff. He will not give the credit of the tombstone name. And that produced a two count. Sting then hit a vertical suplex that sent Scott to the floor. And then Steiner goes for a suplex on the floor. Luger knocks him down. Rick and Lex get into it, and it ends up with all four in the ring. The Steiners attack Luger, and the bell is called at 10:17. Crowd is into the finish at this point with all four brawling. And then the guys from the back run in to break this up involving these four. And then we go back to Bischoff and Heenan at the desk for the wrap-up. And this is when Scott Hall shows up again and tells him to get his three best, he tells Bischoff. He again reiterates that we are taking over and that this will be a war that will be settled in the ring and not on microphones, not in newspapers, not in the dirt sheets, and says we are coming down here and we are taking over. A direct affiliation, of course, to the North-South Divide. Mm-hmm. And throws a toothpick at Bischoff, and the announcers are left speechless. Heenan is shocked, and says we'll see you next week.
Yeah. So,
very buzzworthy show, and you went off with a big, big angle here with Scott Hall's appearance. And again, this was not a show that did a tremendous number, though the following week... I mean, they did a 2-3 this week, and then the following week, they jumped up to a 3.0. A 2.8 this week, and then jumped up the next week.
I really liked how they paced the Scott Hall's appearances here. It was very, very short, very brief, but kind of left you satisfied and wanting more by the end of every episode. So, you know, they could have also just had Scott Hall come out, had a typical beatdown, and then, you know, the match the next week, but... They didn't do that. I thought they'd really maximize the value of these two.
They took, like, whenever you have somebody new or a return, you have all these little steps that in their own way can be their own chapters that can be big things on their own. Mm-hmm. For Scott Hall, just his appearance alone was a big thing that they did on this show. The following week, you have all these questions about what's next and what's Scott Hall doing. You had a whole week that they could use a bye week here before teasing then that another guy is coming. They stretch that out to another week. Then they had the opponent reveal. And the first match wouldn't be until Bash at the Beach. Mm-hmm. So they stretched all of this out instead of just giving it all away in a short amount of time. They let you anticipate a lot. So I like that quite a bit. So this, we now fast forward 2 weeks at this point to June the 10th. This is the final Nitro before the Great American Bash in Wheeling, West Virginia, in front of 3,500 people. This Nitro, despite the surprise and Scott Hall stating that he had a friend coming, did a 2.6. This was actually down from the week prior, and Raw actually beat them this night with a 2.7. Tony Schiavone and Larry Zbyszko start with a very lively crowd, and they plug the Great American Bash this weekend right off the top and state that we have a dream tag match tonight. Ric Flair, Arn Anderson, taking on the Renegade and Joe Gomez. Man, I don't know what dreams Tony Schiavone's been having, but I bet you it involves prescriptions. They show the end of Nitro from the prior week, where Scott Hall confronts Sting at the announce desk, and Sting slaps him, and Hall promises a surprise for tonight. As we mentioned, not dropping the accent despite the legal threats, but that would eventually be phased out. Many things of the Razor Ramon variety would be dropped, and he would just become Scott Hall, American.
I wonder what they determined was a part of the character and what wasn't. I mean, what if the guy actually talked like that?
Well, he didn't, though.
What if he just suddenly started to talk like that, though, in his real life? How do you prove that in court, that you can't talk
like You can't just say, I talk like this now.
Well, why not? People change. I mean,
his character was very much built off of Scarface.
I don't care, but John, at what point do you stop? Do you tell him to cut his hair, no longer curl that little tip at the front? Do you tell him not to have the toothpick?
Well, intellectual property. I mean, it's reasonable, though. This was all
How is an accent part of intellectual property?
Because they came up with that specifically for the character of Razor Ramon.
Now, what about the toothpick? What about the hair?
That's all things.
What about the vest? At what point do you stop, and how do you determine that in the court of law?
Well, they ultimately, I mean, I don't think they were going to, you're not going to get down to, well, you can't wear trunks anymore. I mean, I just don't think that's necessarily reasonable. But if you have catchphrases.
Yeah, like, he didn't do that.
Things that you can argue are profitable, and
the accent is just
not benefiting by wearing a vest.
Right.
The toothpicks, they obviously, I mean, they got rid of those toothpicks. So,
did they? He's had toothpicks his whole career.
Did he always have them in WCW?
I don't know. I don't remember. It's just like, I just don't recall anybody ever copywriting an accent and saying you can't use this accent. So I find that part a little interesting.
It's all the things that you can say are specific to the Razor Ramon character. And
that's hard. That could be very vague.
Look, when Kurt Angle had to go to TNA, and they had, you know,
speak with your Pittsburgh accent.
Well, they said catchphrases, though. Like, it's true. He had to change to...
Catchphrases and accents are different things, though, is what I'm saying.
Well, I just think the accent was because he was this Cuban-based heel. I mean, that was... Mm-hmm. That accent did not exist before the WWF for the guy. He wasn't using that accent before.
In Scarface, but...
Well... Maybe the people behind Scarface could have had quite the issue with the Razor Ramon character.
Yeah, it's just interesting to me. Because I like to know what the precedent is for that.
We've talked about it before, and I'm glad they did not do this with these guys, was the fact that they saw Scott Hall and Kevin Nash, and they totally changed them around to certain degrees. Obviously, they played off of their history. But when we have seen guys go to TNA and you do the knockoff themes... I think there's nothing worse than that.
Yeah, sure.
I feel that.
Though American Made, I mean, as a knockoff, I mean, it's not strictly a knockoff theme. It's not like it's the same.
I'm not talking about Kurt Angle, but
I'm talking about Hogan.
Oh, sorry.
It's not the same. It's not the same theme, but it kind of captures the same feeling as Real American. I like that one. I mean, obviously not as iconic, but you either kind of do something like that, or you go a completely different direction.
So we got the tee up for the show, and then showing the angle from last week, and then we kick the show off with Booker T and Scott Steiner. And Schiavone tells the fans to call their friends and tell them the Great American Bash is this Sunday night, essentially having the fans do their job for them. Much better crowd here than Macon 2 weeks prior. Lots of blocks and counters. Steiner hit a double underhook suplex and clotheslined Booker to the floor. Booker kicked Scott in the face as he runs at him in the corner. There was a belly-to-belly by Steiner, and then the crowd got hot as he signaled for the Frankensteiner, but Booker held onto the ropes. Sidekick delivered to Steiner, and then missed a splash off the top. Steiner hit an overhead belly-to-belly off of an Irish whip and got the win. 5:52.
I really enjoyed seeing a younger, more agile Scott Steiner here. But, you know, make no mistake about it, he was still very large already at this time. Certainly my Scott Putski winner on these shows. But the guy was still wrestling a very technical style of match with a great move set, a lot of high flying, and I just thought a really, really special, tremendous worker here.
Which may be a bonus when you're winning the Scott Putski Award on a show with Lex Luger.
Yeah.
I mean, those are kind of the two. Yep. They are the pillars of that award.
And I feel like Vince has won
Vince does well, too, when he sans shirt. Mm-hmm. Shivani is constantly promoting what will be coming up later tonight. And they frequently would just have different promos, very quick promos, going to break from guys like 10-second spots. Oakland is with Scott Steiner at the entrance after the break, and they plug his big tag match with Brother Rick against Fire and Ice on Sunday, and he promises a winner. We will get a winner in the Steiner's Fire and Ice tag contest. And then Deborah McMichael shows up, and she needs to talk to Gene Okerlund about her husband, and Scott Steiner just simply understands, and he's like, okay, I'll leave. And Deborah could not sleep last night. She's worried about the Great American Bash. She blanks on the date, which Okerlund has to cover and saying, this Sunday. And she's worried about my husband, Steven. She is worried that Steven might go a little crazy and hurt someone permanently. She blames herself, and Gene blames Rick for all of this. And Gene says that Rick has taken visual liberties, whatever that means, and Deborah simply wants to talk this out with Flair and Arn and get the match called off, and Gene's going to try and serve as the mediator and bring these two parties together. And Gene agrees, a whole lot of nuts involved in this. So we're going to try and get to the bottom of this and call this match off on Sunday. It's too dangerous. Then we had the middle-aged stallion, Jim Powers, against Diamond Dallas Page, and they showed these three kids in the front row about a dozen times on this show. They had WCW written across their backs in paint and TNT written on the front. I have a hard time that these three, I will guess 10-year-olds, told their parents, we want TNT on the front and WCW on the back and paint the letters perfectly. I mean, these felt like the ultimate plants. They were all Mitches in the front row here, this felt like.
Ooh, wow.
These kids were showing like every segment, I felt. Zbyszko is disgusted that Deborah is trying to have this match called off, cuts a promo on more football players that tried wrestling, mentioning Alex Karras and Dick Butkus. Powers rolled up Page for a two count. Page got the advantage, hit a gut buster. Powers ran him repeatedly into the turnbuckle and then a back elbow and diamond cutter, and Page won in 4 minutes and 4 seconds. Not much to take from this one. They showed a video on the Benoit-Kevin Sullivan feud, including the Brian Pillman, I Respect You Booker Man finish from Super Brawl.
Yeah, though they basically kind of re-edited it to show like how Sullivan was able to beat him up so bad that he left.
Yeah, so Pillman had legit been released from his contract at this point, and this was right after the Humvee accident. In fact, this might have been, this was just after that, so yeah, they basically used that match to say how Kevin Sullivan ran off Brian Pillman, who would not be returning. And Sullivan is now working with the Horsemen from within and feuding with Benoit, and their False Count Anywhere match will be on Sunday. Video montage of Conan as the United States champion with his eclectic wardrobe.
A pretty corny version of Conan.
Okerlund then interviews Conan, who will be taking on El Gato, a legend, he says, in South America. This legend from South America would be known as Pat Tanaka under a mask on Sunday. Wow. And says any apathy from him will lead to his demise, and he will show none against the dangerous El Gato. Zbyszko says that every contender for the United States title should have a green card. What a division that would be. Ming took on Sting in our rhyming match. Zbyszko goes from insulting immigrants to insulting women over the Deborah situation. And then Ming attacks and is on the offensive. There's a midring crossbody by Sting for a two count. a face plant, and then runs Ming chest first into the turnbuckle. Ming gets crotched on the top and then lands on the mat, applies the Scorpion Deathlock, and Sting gets the win in 3:10. Then we go backstage, and Okerlund is with Deborah and Bobby Heenan. Bobby Heenan is training Arn Anderson and Ric Flair, serving as a coach, and accuses him of talking with Flair privately. And they go to meet Flair in the dressing room, and then Deborah runs out of the room, and Flair and Arn attack Joe Gomez and Renegade backstage, including a figure four being applied. And then that puts the tag match, the dream match, in jeopardy, way. They showed a highlight from the prior week of Regal rolling up Jim Duggan after Dave Taylor stole his 2x4. So we got Dave Taylor, again with Jeeves, against Jim Duggan. Crowd was chanting USA, and this is where we get the announcement that, we're sorry, folks, Renegade and Joe Gomez cannot compete, and Luger and Sting will step in.
Oh, that's not as much of a dream match.
Joe Gomez, you were not gonna get him here in West Virginia. Taylor missed a reverse cross. Duggan ran into the turnbuckle. Then Duggan pulls out a roll of tape, which was very visible in his trunks, and clocks Taylor for the win at 2:26. And the highlight of this was the slow motion replay and Dave Taylor's reaction to taking this punch, like his head was knocked off his shoulders.
I don't really get this. How does wrapping up your hand with two strips, two rolls at best,
very stupid,
of tape helping?
It protects the person delivering it. It by no means makes the punch harder.
He just, like, I get it if, you know, somebody was professionally basically casting their fist, but
this here, is not a Stitch Duran job.
Hacksaw just, like, rolled the tape over twice on his hand, and all of a sudden he had this magical tape that was able to knock out Dave Taylor.
But you know what? It was just a visual.
But what? So then, and wouldn't this result in a DQ?
Apparently not.
The ref clearly in full view of the ref.
No, it's tape. Is it really a weapon?
Maybe it's all, like, just in his head. Yeah. It's like a placebo.
Maybe it's, yeah, he knows that by taping it, he's not going to do as much damage to his hand, and therefore he can fully hit him with all his might.
That makes total sense.
Yes. Then they showed a montage for Mysterio and Malenko featuring some AAA highlights for Rey Mysterio. Okerlund is with Big Bubba and Jimmy Hart backstage, and Bubba has scissors. So we have the former Big Boss Man feuding with the former Earthquake, doing a former gimmick of Brutus Beefcake.
Mm-hmm.
And he's holding Shark's hair. And we get highlights of the greatest promo in the history of John Tenta, where he proclaims, I'm not a fish! I'm not an avalanche! I'm a man!
Oh my god.
I'm John Tenta! I am not a fish! I am not a man! That, I mean, God rest his soul, if he had ever written a book, that would have to be the title.
I'm not a fish, I'm not an avalanche.
I'm a man. I am John Tenta.
And then this statement came up last week.
I'm not an avalanche! I'm a man, John Tenta.
That was the announcement. He was not a fish. He was a man.
I mean, God bless this guy. He had some awful gimmicks in his day, and he was someone that I think understood the camp value for what they were worth. I mean, this was pre-Golga. I mean, he was not by any means through the litany of the gimmick factory and what it would be what would be given to him. Bubba says,
this guy also had to walk around with a half-shaved head for 2 weeks.
Because he was a professional.
Yeah.
The worst thing a wrestler can do to another. Bubba says he is half a man and will leave him laying like a beach whale at Great American Bash. If I'm going to nitpick, this feud happened a month too early.
How?
The end of Shark.
Oh.
This should have been
a
beach match.
You're right. It would have made a huge difference in the
first guy to get thrown into the water.
Yeah.
A drowning match.
It was really the pivotal point of the Monday Night Wars is the fact they didn't do this a month later.
They could fight underwater and John Tenta can breathe. Because he's a shark.
Yeah.
A very spirited close to this by Gene Okerlund plugging more Nitro on TNT. I love this. This is the highlight of both weeks for me. Forget Nash, forget Hall, forget even William Regal. This was the highlight for me. Just the recap of, I'm not a fish. I'm not an avalanche. I'm a man. trying to overcome an avalanche and trying to tread water in this WCW organization. Okerlund then interviewed the charisma machine Scott Norton, who was getting set for a match with that Giant. Holy Christ. They show Giant chokeslamming Ice Train and Orton and Norton from last week. Norton is not scared. And then we got a countdown clock to the second hour.
Yeah.
If there's anything people like more, it's countdowns and top ten lists, Way. Because yeah. These people were going crazy. Pyro goes off to celebrate the start of the second hour of our two-hour show that we knew we were getting when we tuned in.
Got to build anticipation.
Raw could learn a thing or two.
Just countdown, yeah.
So we had the Giant and Scott Norton. There was a power slam by the Giant, a big boot. Norton did land some strikes. Norton then took a choke slam on the floor. Giant rolled him in and pinned him in a minute 42, which was about as long as this needed to go. And then Luger ran in, attacking the Giant. Luger got sent to the floor, and Luger kicks him low to stop a chokeslam through a table, and then the Dungeon of Doom run down. Luger leaves, and he goes to the announce desk and says the rule book is out the window this Sunday, and he has some surprises for the Giant at the Great American Bash.
On both of these shows, they would start the second hour head-to-head with Raw with a world championship match. With the Giant defending.
Yes.
In matches, obviously.
Questionable opponents.
With very little fanfare and, you know.
Shark and Scott Norton.
No repercussions at all. But, I suppose it really showed the how much Monday Night Wrestling programming had changed. From just jobber matches to starting every show with a world title match.
So last week, Lord Steven Regal took on the 21-year-old Alex Wright. This week, Steven Regal took on the 10-year-old Billy Kidman.
He looked like a new Kidman on the block here with his haircut.
Oh, boy. Kidman was actually 22 at this time,
yeah. But
looked all of 10.
Oh, my God. He looked like one of those kids in the front row with the TNT on his chest.
He looked like a guy that was scooped up from a Pennsylvania indie and inserted here onto national television.
Yeah.
Regal attacks him with uppercuts. Kidman drop kicks him into the back of the head and hits a bulldog. Kidman climbs to the top, misses a 450, and Regal hits an overhead suplex and then, like a lion tamer, with his foot on top of Kidman's head for the submission in 56 seconds. As 56-second matches go, I thought they did pretty well.
Sure, absolutely.
This was pretty fun, and it was super quick.
Kidman is very talented, and he played his role here perfectly fine. But this is about as generic and jobber-like as you'll ever see Billy Kidman. You know, plain tights, jean shorts, and the tank were a real upgrade for him.
Sting runs down, attacks Regal, and Regal is stunned at this, and they will have their match on Sunday at the pay-per-view. The Nasty Boys took on Public Enemy, and they all brawl. We go into split-screen mode. Heenan is selling the Great American Bash and says if he was not a part of this event, he would pay $5,000 to see this show.
Okay.
That is the savings you are making by spending your money to buy this on pay-per-view. $5,000 Heenan would drop on this show.
You've convinced me.
But he is, in fact, working the show, so he is not at this, predicament. This settled into a traditional tag. Johnny Grunge was working with a broken hand. Sags hit a pile driver to Grunge as they go to break with a blood runs cold spot. They got the heat on Grunge, and they keep mentioning how the Nasties are super tight with Dennis Rodman. Grunge misses with an elbow drop and lands on top of his partner, Rocco Rock, in a line that certainly, in hindsight, is one that, history, it's just amazing this line was said. Bischoff notes how Johnny Grunge, when he broke his hand, didn't run to his doctor looking for a note when he broke his hand. Now, simply go do some research on Johnny Grunge and when he died, and he was linked to Phil Aston III, a doctor that was accused of significantly over-prescribing people, including Johnny Grunge, and that Grunge was a guy that, his wife brought this to light afterwards, that he was being prescribed pain medication, anti-anxiety medication. This was really big in the wake of the Benoit murder-suicide story, and just the fact that this line was said, obviously a line that doesn't really play well historically, given the nature of Johnny Grunge's death. Rocco Rock used a trash can, got stopped by Knobs in the aisle. Public Enemy got the advantage on Knobs after knocking him off the turnbuckle. Rocco Rock got knocked off the top with a trash can by Sags, and the bell gets called, and then Knobs has this trash can, and from the ring, dumps it onto Rocco Rock's head on the floor, and this whole crowd just gasped at this spot, and the DQ was called. I don't think there was even a bell to start this one.
No. An ugly match, and, you know, they were pretty upfront about it. Bischoff basically telling us
this is what Public Enemy was brought in to do.
Yep.
As were the Nasty Boys, as realistically. Nasty.
Yeah, exactly. You had two very much similar teams. Man, at one point, Sags does these slaps to Rocco Rock that might as well have made Stephanie's look like Kenta Kobashi in comparison. So just not a very pretty match, but, you know what you're getting with these two teams.
We got another Hogan montage. Just in case you forgot about how great this guy is. Just destroying everyone. Mainly focusing on Vader, who of course is now a top guy in the WWF. But also a ton of the Giant here, which I guess they were going to get to this match eventually for the title. But just, like, this just felt very... I guess you did want to keep Hogan in everyone's mind, though I don't think anyone was forgetting about Hulk Hogan, but these packages just felt so out of place on a show where you're getting ready for this pay-per-view on Sunday that Hogan has nothing to do with. To me, you want Hogan in the back of everyone's mind because, of course, the reveal would be a Bash at the Beach the next month. Hmm. Then we got another training video with Steve McMichael and Kevin Green. These two... we're going through strategy on a whiteboard for their game coming up on Sunday and the possibilities of what would happen. And they're trying to think of a good idea for a coach to help them. And they're pondering this as Kevin Green is snacking on a Slim Jim when all of a sudden Einstein McMichael thinks, hey, what about Randy Savage? And they enlist him as their coach, leading the Bobby Heenan coaching Arn and Flair. And Savage showed up at the gym to train with them in his official 1987 fall line in the wrestling world. Plaid shirt, bandana, spandex, and weightlifting belt all together. Which is probably what Randy Savage bought his groceries in as well during this time period. So,
how many Slim Jims do you think Randy Savage...
snapped into?
Yeah, would have had. Like in his... do you think he would... he ate that?
Three. No. The awful salt content. I mean, he was not high on sodium, I don't believe.
Snapped and then spit.
He was a caffeine guy, not a sodium guy. Lex Luger and Sting took on Ric Flair and Arn Anderson for the WCW tag titles in the main event, with Luger and Sting holding the belts. Flair's bouncing around for Luger at the start, runs into Sting on the apron and bumps off of a punch on the edge. Bischoff tells fans that if you're having a Nitro party, take a Polaroid. And if it passes censorship, we will show it on the air.
This is the...
These are the things I love about 20-year-old shows.
The old school Instagram.
Guys, come on. Let's go to Polaroidy. Is that what you would call it?
Yeah, I don't know. And then what, you have to physically mail it in?
I guess you'd have to snail mail the hard...
Nobody had scanners back then.
And then you'd have to scan it to get it onto the broadcast. Yeah. Or maybe Bischoff would just hold up the Polaroid and you could zoom in.
Yeah. Well,
Sting comes in, hit a face buster to Arn, press slam to Flair. Crowd was cheering along. Flair runs and grabs a chair, but drops it before returning to the ring. They go through the commercial break. Bischoff continually would refer to Randy Savage as, quote, the biggest cashew of them all. The nut. What a t-shirt opportunity. Spinebuster by Arn to Sting. They isolated Sting for a while. Arn comes in. He's working over the left knee of Sting. Another commercial break. Sting continues to sell. Builds for the hot tag. Finally makes it to Luger. He fires up on Arn and Flair. And then the Giant enters, and the referee throws the match out as Luger attacks the Giant. He runs into a forearm from the Giant. Then Scott Steiner comes in and attacks the Giant with a wooden chair, with Sting using a wooden one as well. There is a big standoff between the Giant and the babyfaces, and the Giant exits. And then Okerlund interviews the Giant, who says Luger is a dead man and there are no rules on Sunday, and promises that Luger will go out on a stretcher.
Yeah. I thought the match was actually quite good, and I thought it was actually quite almost poetic that we had Ric Flair and Arn Anderson teaming up against Sting and Lex Luger in the match that took place right before the whole NWO thing occurred. I don't think you could find a more representative tag team match of that era of WCW prior to the NWO than these four men. I thought they actually did a very good job together.
And the final angle to close off the show, we go back to Bischoff and Heenan at the desk, and Heenan cuts this fiery promo on Randy Savage. He's yelling, and then Heenan just bolts as Scott Hall appears, leaving Eric Bischoff on his own. Bischoff asks Hall, "Where's the big surprise?" as the camera zooms out to reveal Kevin Nash as Bischoff turns around. Nash says that Bischoff's been running his mouth for 6 months, says this is where the big boys play, noting the adjective, play.
The adjective.
Yes.
Play. Oh, my God.
Kevin Nash.
The man with half the brain that I do.
Yes, he would be on the receiving end of that promo. Look at the adjective. Bischoff needs, he is told to go find three of his best for a future match. And then Nash says, he makes a comparison to how boring this show is, as to makes a reference to Marge Schott. Now,
he says this show is about as boring as Marge Schott reading Mein Kampf. He had a terrible fucking promo here. I don't recall this that well. Everybody just kind of sees this in highlight form. But
it's always, the adjective line is always repeated, but the Marge Schott line is not, which is probably, between this and the Adolf Hitler references on Nitro, they certainly were not exactly maintaining much when it came to, I mean, I'm surprised that both of these lines got onto a Nitro broadcast.
I mean, Marge Schott was just, that was like a known, it was a popular reference at the time, but like, just the content of it, you couldn't get a paleontologist to get these dinosaurs out here?
And get them off of a dialysis machine.
Oh my God, just terrible, terrible line.
That was like a subtle, like their kidneys have shut down from drug use? I mean, what were we implying here?
That they're old.
Well, he refers to Thunder in Paradise as Blunder in Paradise.
Oh my God.
Which is like a title we would come up with on Review or Wrong.
No, we wouldn't. Please give us some more credit. We'd shoot that down immediately.
He asks where Hogan is, calls out Savage, and Bischoff says he will try and get them their fight. He invites them to the Great American Bash, and he'll see if he can get them their fight. And Nash says the measuring stick just changed around here as they pose to the crowd, and Bischoff tells them to cut. Now, in terms of being deceptive, if you went off the air, did you not get the sense that these guys were wrestling on Sunday? That was heavily implied here. I thought, show up this Sunday and I will try and get you your fight.
I mean, maybe.
That's how I took it.
Maybe.
I think they wanted it open-ended, that they may fight on Sunday.
I also feel like at this point, I would have just been a fan who was craving an appearance to see what they would have done. But yeah.
In fairness, if you did tune in, no, you didn't get them in a match, but you got a great angle at the pay-per-view with them, and it did set up the match.
Yeah.
So, in terms of just a strict go-home show, I thought they really did a good job of hammering on the key matches for the Great American Bash, and by the end of this, I wanted to watch this show.
Yeah, I thought so.
And it doesn't hurt that the Great American Bash is a very good show.
Right, yes. But, you know, the two things that we watched the show for were the NWO appearances, and I thought Scott Hall did tremendous in last week's show and this week's show. But I had no recollection of Nash's promo being this bad. I thought it was just fucking awful. I mean, the guy's a big star, so I thought this was all cool. Just the visual was nice, but his performance was just shit.
I think he also had weeks to think of this promo, and sometimes that can be a bad thing, where you're putting so much thought into what your big statement is. This is the hot angle of the time. You're trying to follow up on Scott Hall's debut. It's like, what am I going to say that's just so clever? And I think this was
paleontologist.
Yes, Marge Schott.
Yeah. Blunder in Paradise. That's brilliant.
Because it's Thunder in Paradise. So there you have it. I don't think that these were historically significant episodes of Nitro on their own. I thought the second episode better than the first one we reviewed. I think a better crowd in the second one. Both shows had their good and bad.
These weren't actually all that bad. I would say
they were paced
worse.
Very well.
Yeah,
I thought.
These are actually kind of decent shows to watch. And you know, you also had little highlights in there, like seeing Regal work and seeing a younger Scott Steiner wrestle and seeing Arn and Flair that I actually quite enjoyed going back to watch. So and I thought the overall Kevin Nash's promo aside, I thought all the NWO teasing was done really well.
And especially at this time, big positive that I enjoyed about Nitro was they tried to make a lot of things feel important and special, even if they weren't, and they gave you this feeling that this is the hot show. You want to be tuned in for this. Even things like, yeah, we can mock the countdown to the second hour, but they made it feel like this is a party going on.
It was effective.
Exactly, and there's a lot of elements here that I think could really help Raw for some of those shows that can drag.
You're telling me that we need a countdown to every hour? Is that
I'm not saying that. I'm saying that it could really help than just simply...
Third hour countdown starting...
There's no way you can say that there's...
9:50.
Raw, at times, could really drag. And I didn't get that same feeling on Nitro at the same time, because they did give a lot of immediacy to a lot of the elements on their shows. So that was Monday Nitro. So, Mr. Ting, we are now going to head off to the message board. Lawradio.proboards.com. And our first one comes from McWhalen. The arrival of Scott Hall was the opening salvo in the Monday Night Wars. But other than that... Should be Monday Night War, correct?
Wars.
There weren't wars going on. It was a war, correct?
Sure.
And maybe maybe it's an overstatement. Maybe
you say World War One. I mean, actually, that was like there were like a few battles. I guess it's one great big war. Yeah.
Other than that, the May 27th show sucked something fierce. The American Males Horseman match was the best match, but the rest of the card was a nosedive. The TV title match was just terrible, and the rest of the matches were either too short, bad, or both. The main event was passable, and Regal and Alex Wright was okay, but the commentary distracted way too much from the other match. Other than the historical aspect, this Nitro should be passed on. The contrast, the June 10th Nitro, may just be one of the better two-hour Nitros ever. The Booker-Steiner match was short, but really good, and the main event was very fun to watch. Nash showing up wasn't as mind-blowing as Hall's arrival, and Nash having a grammar fail with look at the adjective play, when we all know play is a verb. Still, this Nitro was way better than the earlier one. The first Nitro gets a 3 out of 10, the second a 7.5 out of 10.
Ronaldo from Milan, Italy. These episodes bring back memories of watching Nitro on the UK version of TNT using a huge satellite dish on my balcony. When Hall came through the crowd, I immediately dialed my friend going, "Did you see that?" Yep, I was a huge mark. And yes, indeed, I believe the WWF had actually sent Razor Ramon in to start a war. Memories have marked them. I wouldn't trade for anything. The Nash episode was pretty much a given, expected surprise, but I still think it's not so much the guys who debuted as it is the verbiage and kayfabe-breaking comments that they did, which was rare back in the day. That made it look legit and genuine, but of course, it only lasted a few months before the NWO started adding random members and lost its steam.
Ryan in Calgary. I was a committed WWF fan in 1996, mainly because my only access to WCW was in the ads and comic books for video games. I can distinctly remember when the fake Diesel and Razor showed up, and 13-year-old me had to look for a little while to figure out that they were totally different dudes. Watching these episodes, it's clear they were totally different products. The show is presented a lot more like a sport with real people working out their differences and competing in structured athletics and a lot less suspension of disbelief. There are indicators that the process of moving towards a more dramatic approach is well underway. Ultimately, pro wrestling is about balancing those tensions to present a compelling show. All in all, I give these episodes 9.5 Scott Putzkis, but only 8 out of 10 overall. Would you guys consider reviewing a Raw, Nitro, and or ECW TV episode from the same week during the 90s peak period? It's interesting to track storylines like this, but I think side-by-side reviews would be cool as well. For fun, I checked out the Hardcore TV from May 28, 96, and it had a lot of Brian Pillman and a 70-year-old woman in the front row of a New Jack main event. He also has a lengthy television question, but my head's about to explode, and I feel I won't be able to get through it.
Hey, ask us privately. Jesse from Lincoln, Nebraska. Hey, guys, sorry for making this so long, but I'd like to thank Scott Hall for saving me from a crappy relationship. Me and some friends of mine met Scott Hall in the parking lot at an In Your House pay-per-view in Omaha shortly before he left. We got a picture with him and asked him if he was leaving to WCW, and he said, I go where the money goes, bro. I thought that was an awesome answer. The Monday night he showed up on WCW, my girlfriend at the time wanted to move in together. Everyone told me to break up with her, but I wouldn't listen. We were sitting in her parents' living room with Nitro in the background. Then out from the audience came Razor Ramon. Even though I knew he was leaving to WCW, I still thought the whole thing was a shoot. My girlfriend was trying to get my attention about moving in together, but I wasn't paying attention to her. Later on, I found out she cheated on me, but I didn't care because as sad as it sounds, I had wrestling to fall back on. 10 toothpicks to Eric Bischoff's face.
That's feedback I like, Eric. How these shows had an impact on your personal lives.
Yeah.
There you go. Jesse from Lincoln, Nebraska. No selling the cheating. DK from CT. Not just the beginnings of a historic angle, but something that 2016 WWE could have learned from. Nitro got Razor Ramon and Diesel for a couple of months in 1996 because they didn't immediately start referring to Hall and Nash when they arrived. Not until Bash at the Beach, if I remember correctly. By the same token, WWE could have had the Bullet Club for a bit just by not giving the faction any name at all. Obviously, you can't pretend in 2016 that Anderson and Gallows aren't under contract. But people would still be calling them the Bullet Club and not the Club if WWE didn't force the name on us almost right away. Overall, like many shows from the 90s, these two Nitros are a reminder that the bell-to-bell action today on the average draw is pretty good compared to back then, but they are also a throwback to when the storytelling was generally better than it is now.
Daniel from Norway. Hi guys, I've never actually watched the whole WCW show before these two. So the matches and segments that the WWE loved to put the focus on, such as the Hall and Nash segment, have been the base of my WCW knowledge. These shows did definitely not give me any desire to further take advantage of the WCW archive on the WWE network, because I didn't watch wrestling during this period of time. Nostalgia could not salvage my opinions of these shows, especially considering how spoiled I would become by today's in-ring standards. Personalities and lack of athleticism is my two main criticisms. However, I did enjoy the performance of Ric Flair in both of these shows, Hall's first appearance and the backstage interviews. I felt the interviews had something that is absent from the current product, but I can't exactly put my finger on it. Most memorable moment for me was Jim Duggan and his taped hand. By the way, what was the appeal of DDP?
Hey, DDP gets a lot of criticism. The guy did get over.
Yeah, and I don't really know if you necessarily saw DDP at his greatest here on these episodes. But, I mean, I wasn't really a WCW fan at the time, but what in your opinion, were the standout qualities that made him attractive to a fan base?
He worked hard. Like, this was a guy that he got a lot of criticism because so many of his matches were mapped out. I've never cared about that stuff. I think people in the industry critique that. As a fan or someone watching this, I don't know why you would care how a match is structured as long as it gets over. And he was a guy that, to me, look at how late he got into this, how hard the guy worked. He got over, and in 97 and even more so in 98, he became a very big star.
And what was it about the character that you think people latched onto?
I think he became the one of the focal babyface foils to the NWO. I think he benefited greatly when he turned down the NWO. Got the Diamond Cutter was an extremely over finish at the time. And he got very, very popular. And he got some good matches out of guys like Bill Goldberg when they were not having great matches pay-per-view by pay-per-view. And he got a very good match out of him in October of 98. So I always thought that he was a guy that his matches were laid out very well, was an over character, and I thought that there was a certain time period when he was an extremely effective babyface.
I thought he had a very good, like, genuine charisma about him. So that you knew that this guy in real life probably sounded just like the dude, you know, cutting the promo. And he didn't really feel like he was trying to play too much of an over-the-top character. It just kind of felt like a turned-up exaggeration of who he actually was. And he seemed like a likable dude.
Yeah, he was never at the level of Goldberg, but I mean, there was a period in 98 where he was number two, and even at that period, he was being plugged ahead of Goldberg when they did the tag match with Karl Malone and Dennis Rodman, and he was getting a lot of different mainstream appearances. So there was a time period. Diamond Dallas Page was very effective. All right, that's going to wrap up the show, everybody. We are done. Because Nitro did such a great job of building it up, next week we are going to review The Great American Bash, 1996.
Oh, we are.
Yes.
We're the follow-up to this.
The follow-up to
this. Okay, cool.
Headlined by The Giant and Lex Luger.
Mm-hmm.
With no rules. And will they show up? Will these two mystery men appear to find out if they will get their fight or not?
The challenge has been made.
It has been made. Plus, Rey Mysterio's WCW debut.
Yeah.
So all that and more is coming up on next week's show. And I totally forgot about this because we're going to end off the show with Paul Heyman. Because we dug up in our archives Paul Heyman when he chatted with Jason Agnew. This was at the end of 2006. And, yeah.
Do we have a guest for next week?
Oh, yes, yes. We should announce that as well.
That was a good thing.
Next week, we are going to be joined by a guest reviewer. I didn't know if we were going to do a surprise or not, but let's just announce
it. Oh. I don't care.
We will be joined by Paul Heyman next week. No, to review Great American
Bash. We'll have a big man. The big man will show up next week.
Yes. We will be joined by the mystery third man.
Yeah.
Third man will be here.
Yeah.
But we're going to end off with Paul Heyman. Once again, this was an interview with Jason Agnew at the end of 2006 with his assessment of how Eric Bischoff and WCW utilized Kevin Nash and Scott Hall after they were signed over from the World Wrestling Federation.
What Bischoff did is that Bischoff took a situation where here were these established stars. They broke away from their WWE branding. They then broke away from the WCW branding, came up with their own idea of, so to speak, of the NWO, the New World Order, and said, this is where wrestling is headed. We three embody a whole different concept. And they took that concept with the spray painting and the interrupting of the TV shows and their style of shoot-style promos and all the things that was renegade in that era and portrayed WCW as the establishment and the NWO as the revolutionaries. Same thing ECW did when we broke away from the NWA. We said, that's wrestling since 1905 with George Hackenschmidt and Frank Gotch, and we're the new era. And we rebel against everything that came before us. And it's the same thing that the NWO did. The NWO came on and said, everything that came before us sucked, and we're something new. Pay attention to us, because we're going to revolutionize this industry. And we're black, you know, they were black and white. They were everything that was conventional, they went against. It was a complete revolution in front of your very eyes. I don't think that's what TNA is doing right now. And I don't see how it correlates to what the NWO did. NWO was a fantastic concept because it went against everything that people were bitching about with WCW. And at the same time, did it with people who were branded on the other show and took them out of that environment, and instead of calling Kevin Nash Diesel, he called himself by his real name. Ooh, that was shocking at the time. And Scott Hall wasn't Razor Ramon anymore. He's just Scott Hall. Well, oh my God, something shoot-like is happening here. And the comments that they were making at the time were not being made on a national basis. We were doing it in ECW, but it wasn't on a worldwide, global, international, or even national platform. So what they did appeared to be the most revolutionary thing in wrestling at the time.